Hello.
So as you understood, our aim today is actually to avoid the traffic in the bistro. So we'll go till 1:45 or so, and there's no traffic anymore in the bistro. So you don't want to wait there anyway. Anyway, so I'll have three lectures, and they will basically, lead towards renormalization. And so in today's lecture, I will do basically the background material for that. I'll just do some preparation. We'll start the real renormalization tomorrow. It'll be horrible, horrible calculation. Basically, the whole lecture will be a calculation. But we will be highly rewarded for that on Friday, where we actually will triumph and we'll calculate critical exponents, which are much better to reality than actually the mean field theory approximation. So that's our goal. So today is preparation. Tomorrow, horrible calculation. On Wednesday, we triumph, okay? So let me just start very, very slowly and tell you what we are trying to achieve. So what is the goal? And so basically, it's very simple. We want to understand continuous phase transitions close to the critical point. So it's to understand. And the word continuous is very difficult, very important. Phase transition near the critical point. So, why do I stress that it's continuous? Is that there are various kinds of phase transitions in nature. So, if you look at phase transitions in nature, well, you are familiar with first order phase transition, for example, first order. For example, that of if you are boiling water and you are making vapor out of that, that will be first order phase transition, typically. And then another type is this continuous one. But you have many other types. So, for example, you have infinite order phase transition. And these are typically related to something which is called topological phase transition. So, for example, you can have phase transition that you have liquid, and under certain temperature, this liquid starts forming vortices or stuff like that. It's like topological defects. It's completely different type of phase transition, but it's also a phase transition. So these are usually topological. A big subject is liquid glass phase transitions. I don't know anything about those, but it's a very, very big subject. And finally, even bigger subject is quantum phase transitions, which actually, by definition, occur at phi equal to zero. So anything what we are doing, if you talk about classical phase transitions, they happen at finite temperature, whereas the quantum, by definition, happen at t equal to zero. So now we will only concentrate on these first two, on the first one, first order and the continuous. And let me just really stress the difference. So both these phase transitions are characterized by an existence of the order parameter. So you have a quantity, so which you call order parameter. Let me call it x. For the Ising ferromagnet, it will be just the magnetization. So, for example, magnetization. For liquid gas phase transition, it will be just the difference between the densities. So, between gas and liquid, for example. There are many other examples. I have a very cute example from black hole physics, but let's not go into that. So, there's many, many examples of order parameters. And basically, the existence of this order parameter is related to symmetry breaking. So we are breaking some symmetry. So this is related to so for example, above TC for your Ising ferromagnet, you know that there is a symmetry. If you flip all the spins up or down, there is a symmetry in the Hamiltonian. It can go from sigma to minus sigma. But you know that below TC, the system actually likes to choose one direction. So, So you are breaking this symmetry, and actually, so it's related to symmetry breaking. So now, let me distinguish the first one, first order, and a continuous phase transition. So first order. So now, if I plot my order parameter x, as it depends on temperature, the typical behavior is that it is zero up to some TC, and then suddenly it is non-zero, but it jumps sort of at that TC. So this is a typical behavior of first order phase transition, whereas typical behavior of the second order or continuous one, it means that really the order parameter is continuous at TC. So I have x, and then the typical picture is this one. And I really continuously go here. So this point where it starts at TC, it starts becoming non-zero, is called critical point. So is here. You have critical point here, but the order parameter is not continuous there. So now, which of these do you think happens more often in nature? It's the first order phase transition. And the reason for that is that you always want to start with the lowest possible order phase transition. So the first order is the first one you can do. And this only does not happen if you have some kind of symmetry which protects this to happening. So occur very often in nature they are connected with latent heat. So usually there is something which is called latent heat, which means if I really want to change my water into gas, I have to pump the energy into that system. But of course, if you don't have that energy, water is very, very happy living next to gas, right? So only if I provide this latent heat, I can actually undergo this phase transition, right? So what it means is that if I don't do that, the distinct phases actually can happily live next to each other. Phases can exist in equilibrium. So typically, if you have that liquid gas thing, right? So it's my P and T, solid liquid gas. So, and there's a critical point here. So first order phase transition, for example, happens if I cross this line here. So liquid and gas at this temperature and that pressure can live happily together unless I pump the energy into the system and, let's say, evaporate my liquid, right? So that's this thing. So now there's another property which characterizes first order phase transitions, which is not very nice. And it's actually, these first order phase transitions are very, very difficult to describe. They always depend on microscopics. So difficult to describe. So each one of them is different. Describe, they depend on microscopics. So for this reason, theoreticians don't like them, right? Because you really need to do all the dirty work. You need to write down the microscopic Hamiltonian. You need to try to solve it. Very, very difficult. What theoreticians like are these continuous phase transitions, okay? So because these are more often, these are less often. So basically, you need symmetry, which would protect the first one, needs symmetry. If you don't have that symmetry, the first order phase transition would happen instead. But what is very nice about them is that they demonstrate universality. So there is something which every phase transition has, you know, in common with the other phase transition. And of course, this is encoded in the critical exponent, which you have seen already. So if I define T minus TC over TC to be my small t, then, and consider the ordered phase, of course, will happen for t smaller than zero, then I can define various critical exponents. And so you know that the specific heat is defined as t to minus alpha. The susceptibility is proportional to. So basically what you are trying to do is you are trying to extract the divergent part of these quantities. So these quantities usually diverge. If you do the experiment, you'll find that the specific heat diverges at a critical point. And you are trying to find how the divergence happens. Okay. The magnetization, on the other hand, must be continuous. So that's why it's a positive power of beta. And the magnetic field depends on delta. And finally, you have the other two. So you have the correlation function, and it's proportional to E to minus R over psi over R D minus 2 plus eta. And psi is proportional to T to minus nu. So you have critical exponents alpha, beta, gamma, delta, which are like the classical ones. And then you have your correlation length diverges at a critical point. And how it diverges is measured by this exponent nu. And also is this strange thing, which basically tells you that something is wrong with your dimensional analysis, is this anomalous dimension eta. So you have six critical exponents which describe your system. And so now what happens is actually that for various systems, these critical exponents are surprisingly the same. So that's why you say the behavior is actually universal, because you have liquid gas phase transition and you have ferromagnet paramagnet phase transition, and they have exactly the same critical exponents. Okay, so you can do universality classes. Universality classes, and you know, have the same critical exponents. So you say two systems belong to the same universality class if they have the same alpha, beta, gamma, and delta critical exponents. Okay, and so we have seen in tutorial that actually, not all of these critical exponents are independent. And you have so-called scaling laws, which actually bind them to be something. So typically, only two are actually independent. And you have the scaling laws like alpha plus 2 beta plus gamma equals to 2. Alpha plus beta times delta plus 1 equals to 2. Gamma equals to nu times 2 minus eta. And alpha equals to 2 minus nu times d, where d is the dimensional length of the system. Okay, so you have six critical exponents, but you have basically four equations which force them. Which you have to enforce, so in the end you have only two independent critical exponents. So some of these are actually not valid for every system. So for example, this one may not be valid. So in that case, you would have more than two. Yes? Yes? Oh, we'll see. I'll just show you a picture now. So don't worry. Okay. So you know, this one and possibly that one may not be satisfied. So you would have more than two independent critical exponents. And so this is called Rushbrook, this is called Griffiths, this is called Fisher's, this is called Josephson law. Okay, but really only two. And so this is really observed experimentally. So if you do the experiment, you really observe and measure, let's say, these two, and then you can really predict what the others are, and you can verify that it's true. So this is really experimentally confirmed. And so it's because of this complete universality, people actually like continuous phase transitions much more than first order phase transitions.
If you have a system where you don't have an analog magnetization system, would it be included in universality class, and would you have to define an anti-magnetization?
Yeah, exactly. So you would, in the precise way as you define, let's say, chi as a derivative of your free energy, or c is two derivatives of your free energy with respect to t, you would define corresponding quantity. You don't have to talk about magnetization. You can talk about, let's say, this density difference. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it's just you define analogous quantities. It doesn't have to be susceptibility. Yeah. So now, what is the main message out of this is that you have seen that there is some approximation which is called mean field theory approximation, and you know, can qualitatively is good. Describes these phase transitions. Describes continuous phase transition. But what is bad about your mean field theory? It gives the wrong critical exponents. Okay, so gives wrong prediction for the value of the critical exponents. No. So if you theoretically have systems which have more dimensions than four, then mean field theory actually is exact, and you can show that. Okay. So now, of course, our aim is to elaborate on this. And so what actually mean field theory ignores is the fluctuations in the system, right? So you need to include fluctuations, and then you would have the full description. So aim is to include fluctuations, and of course, get the right critical exponents. And the way we will do that is the method of renormalization. Okay, so just to have an idea before we go, so this is to review what we want to do. You really want to concentrate only on continuous phase transitions. We know that they are universal, so we know that there is certain approximation which can describe them qualitatively. But it's not quantitatively right. So in order to be quantitatively right, you have to do this horrible thing, which is called renormalization. Okay. So can I have the screen down, please? Let's see if it works. Maybe it doesn't. maybe it doesn't. I'll have to do it myself then. So it's really, just to show you that picture which I gave you and it's distributed in these things. So let's take a look how really a second order phase transition happens and how it really looks like if you look at real data from your Ising ferromagnet. And it's already there. It's not here. Let's wait. But in the meantime, you can look at your picture. And so you see three different pictures. So the first one is below TC. The middle one is exactly TC. And the right one is above TC. So of course, I model by black dots the spins up, and by white dots, or if you want, the spins down. So now you see that above TC, there is complete disorder. So you have, the same number of spin ups, same number of spin downs, which means that the total average magnetization is of course zero. On the other hand, if I am below TC, you see that huge blocks of spins are now correlated, and so you have. So of course now magnetization is non-trivial, which means that there is more spins, let's say up. There is more black area than there is white area. Okay. So now the middle picture is something in between. So how we can characterize this picture here? So as the idea basically of this block spin renormalization. So now you start looking at the system. What happens with the system as you actually zoom out? So if I zoom out of this picture, of course, I lose track where the black dots were and where the white dots were. And I just see gray mass, right? So like uniform background of my state, but I don't see any details. If I zoom out of this system here, because the black areas are much bigger than the white areas, if I zoom out, in the end, I will see the thing as completely black. Okay? So it's something like if you are diagonalizing, let's say, matrix, and you have two eigenvalues, lambda 1 and lambda 2, and then you are making a big power of that. So of course, all that matters in the end is the bigger eigenvalue, right? So you completely lose information. The other one is completely unimportant, right? So in the same way, if I say that it's only a little bit more spins up, so if you are actually zooming out, in the end, you will see everything black. So now, the situation in between is exactly the critical point. And what you will find out is actually, no matter at which scale you are looking at that, it will always look the same. It's completely scale invariant. It's even conformally invariant, as was pointed out in yesterday's lecture. But basically, no matter how far I zoom out, I still see the same type of structure. It has a fractal structure, exactly at critical point. So what also happens at critical point that your correlation length diverges. So what is correlation length? Basically, correlation length tells you how big the blobs of the same spins are, typically, right? So here, it's really, really small. It's the size of the black spot, right? So it's definitely much smaller than the size of the system. So let's say this is my size of the system. And typically, the correlation length is much, much smaller here. Here, what you could show is that actually these blocks of black things sort of can, so if you just keep jumping from black spots, so here is this, so it's like a river flowing here. But anyway, so basically what you can say is that the typical size of these box spins is size of the system. So really the correlation length is of the size of the system, which means it sort of diverges. So really the spins, so the blobs of spins become of the order of the size of the system. That means that your correlation length diverges. Of course, here I have also this thing here. And the only difference between this one and that one is that here I have a scaling invariant. Here I don't. If I zoom out, I get everything black. Here, if I zoom out, I get everything the same as before. That's what I would think. We had a discussion before the class about this, and let me find out. But I would naively say, yeah, because the size of the block is, of course, of the order. And this is precisely what I was just saying. So I think it's wrong, but anyway. So below TC, I have, you know, larger sizes of the black, of the spins. And now we can start zooming out. So let's say I look at the same system from twice as far, and then twice and twice, and in the end, I see everything completely black because I just lose the information about simply, you know, the dominant lambda, the dominant eigenvalue of a matrix simply dominates, right? So on the other hand, if you are above TC, you should have the same number of spin ups and spin downs, right? So no matter how I zoom out, I should basically see none of them should dominate, right? You should have, in the end, the same amount of spin ups and spin downs, which is not really true here. So that's why I think it's wrong. But anyway, so below TC, it's really, the magnetization is equal to zero, right? And so if I had a critical exactly, no matter at which size I would be looking at it, it still looks the same. Okay. So this is what we are talking about when we are talking about continuous phase transition. This is what we have in mind. So the correlation length diverges, and we have scaling invariance exactly at TC. Is this clear? OK, so can I have this up again, please? Let's see if it works this time. Yes? Sorry, what is? I don't have picture what exactly happens at TC, but it's the previous picture. It's really this fractal structure. So if I'm looking at it, at no matter which distance away, it will still look the same. So, you know, I will still have the blocks which are basically of the order of the system, of the order of my whole view. It is fractal. Exactly. It is fractal. No, no, at TC it is fractal. Yeah, so the other, yeah, look at the first picture mainly. The second one, I don't think that it's actually entirely correct. Okay, so this is what we want to do. Yes?
Is there any connection between the fractal dimension of TC to the
normal? It's a very good question. I guess there must be, but I don't know. Yeah, but I would say there must be. Yes. Well, basically, no. The correlation length is more like, you know, what are the typical size of the blocks which are correlated, which have the same spin up?
This is
right. Maybe. The answer is maybe, yeah. Yeah, so this is only in the vicinity of critical point. Yeah, but you always find this structure for any continuous phase transition. And you know, and moreover, you have these universality classes where the critical exponents are the same. Well, generally, I don't know. We shall see precise definition for rising model, right? But generally, there must be, yeah. But yeah. So let me now do a second step towards renormalization. So I still don't do anything about renormalization. It was just a review of what we are trying to do. But I'll try to show you that we can start with the microscopic Hamiltonian, which is just a Hamiltonian for statistical physics, and end up with a field theory. And we will start from the field theory and do renormalization in field theory to actually get the right critical exponents. So second will be from Ising to field theory. And of course, what I'll be doing here is demonstrated on an example of the Ising model, but you can do it basically, well, maybe it may be more complicated, but you can do it in the same way for other systems as well. So let me just remind you that Ising model is defined by your Hamiltonian, which is minus 1/2 sum of ij, jij, sigma I, sigma j, sum of my spins, it can be plus minus 1. And the partition function is just the exponential of this, so it's sum over all the spins. E2. Now I'll be using KB equal to 1. So instead of beta, I'll just write 1 over T. And so it's E to minus beta times Hamiltonian, which is this thing, sum over ij, jij, sigma I, sigma j. Okay. So now, of course, you can do this sum explicitly in one dimension. But if you are in higher dimensions or whatever, it's more complicated. So in order to avoid that, let's use some death trick. So fast. So there'll be two steps in which we will get this field theory out of that. The first formal step is called Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. Okay. So A is we apply Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. So now this sounds very formidable, but what it is Gaussian integration. Okay. So let me just remind you that you can calculate the Gaussian integral from minus infinity to infinity over my variable phi e to minus 1/2 a phi square plus b phi. And you know that this equals to 1 over a e to b square over 2a, as long as a is positive. Okay, so that's our Gaussian integral. I don't know how to calculate it, but you should know. So now, of course, you can generalize this. So this is for one real variable phi. You can generalize it to n dimensions. So then I'll have d phi 1, d phi 2, d phi 3, and so on. So now, of course, this will become, because now phi is a vector, right? So I can generalize small a to be a matrix. So then I have aij, phi I, phi j, and this will be again a vector. So bi, phi I. And so then what happens is that this is just inverse of the matrix, aij, and this will be just a determinant of the matrix. Okay. So now let me do a dirty trick without writing it down, that I will just rename a to minus a, a to minus one. So then your result, if you generalize to n dimensions, is I start writing the right hand side. So I have bi aij bj. So that's that. And equals to 1 over determinant of my matrix A. And there is this factor 2 pi to n half. And then I have multiple integral d phi 1, d phi n. And then e to minus 1 half phi I aij minus 1 phi j. And then plus bi phi I. So this is a high dimensional generalization of this thing. And the only thing which may be confusing is that before I had 1 over a, so a to minus 1. Now I'm just renaming a to minus 1 to a. So I'm just writing a here. But otherwise, it's exactly the same form. OK. So this is what it is. This is Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. So let's apply it to a rising model. So we want to actually, you know, expand this guy in terms of the integral on the right-hand side. OK. So what we do is that we identify. So now if you stare at these two relations, it's very simple. Aij is just jij over my temperature. And my bi vector is just my spins, sigma I. OK. And then if you do that, so your partition function is now. Question? No? OK, I'll just write what it is. So it is a so this I get from my determinant of A. This guy is the determinant of A. OK. And then I have 1 over 2 pi and half. I still have my sum over sigmas. OK, sum over sigma I. And then whatever that integral is, so integral from minus infinity to infinity. So instead of writing d phi 1 to d phi n, let me just write big D, looking like we have a field theory of phi. Let's just write d phi, meaning d phi 1, d phi 2, d phi 3, and d phi n. OK. And whatever is there, so it's e to minus 1 half. And now I'll get a t there, phi I, j I j minus 1, phi j, plus sigma I, phi I. OK. So yes?
Are we sure that the j I j is invertible?
That's a good point. In our case, it will be, in general, if I have 0, well, I can probably invert it block by block, I guess. I think it's OK. Probably OK. OK, so this is what our set is. So now notice two interesting things. And now you were wondering in tutorial that I said always, you know, the divergent part of free energy is this and that, meaning that we don't care when we talk about phase transitions, we don't care about the analytic part of the free energy. In other words, we can throw away everything which is analytic in temperature, right? In particular, if you look at this guy here, Oh no. Let me do one more step. Sorry for that. Let me do one more step. Which is really a tiny step, but just to have all the units and everything correct. So what people do before, actually they do what I'm trying to do now, is that they say, well, let's change variables and let's go from phi to some phi times t or phi divided by t. Okay, so let's just change variables and it will look a little bit better. And that's what people usually do. So this equals 2. And now what I will do is that I go from phi I to phi I over t, and just to get rid of t. So then I have 1 over that j, square root of that, 1 over 2 pi t now, and half. And then I still have the sum sigma I and minus infinity to infinity d phi e to minus 1. So now t is actually, before it was like t half, now it's 1 over 2 t. Okay, phi I j I j minus 1 phi j plus phi I sigma I over t. Okay, so this is what it is. It's just... Well, so this is some kind of field. And yeah, you can make it temperature dependent, or it's, you know, just fluctuating field, and it will fluctuate differently if the temperature changes. So it's a function of T now, if you want. Yes. So now what I was trying to say before, people throw away everything which is analytic. So in particular, what stands before my sum is obviously analytic in T, it's just some power of T, right? So it definitely doesn't contain any divergences, right? So it doesn't help me to understand phase transition. So I just set it equal to 1. Because I don't care about that. Okay, so that's first step. Second step, if you just look at this thing here, and so these are my spins, sigma i's are my spins. So if you look at what this expression looks like, is that before these spins were interacting with each other, sigma I, sigma j terms. So now these spins are interacting with my field phi I. Only. It's only a linear term in sigma I now. So basically, this is like mean field theory approximation, where you said, in mean field theory, you said, well, let my spins interact with an average field produced by other spins. So here you are upgrading a little bit better. Here you are saying, let my spins interact with a field, phi I, so it's, which, however, now can fluctuate. So you are doing better than mean field theory. This is actually exact, right? So far, we haven't done any approximation. So this, you know, this time here tells you that we have interaction of spin sigma I with some fluctuating field. Okay, so you know, so in mean field theory, we had that phi was equal to phi bar, which was equal to the magnetization, basically something like this. Well, okay, so now we are doing better, because before it was just a constant, which we assumed, just constant magnetization everywhere in my lattice. Here is some field which can fluctuate. Okay. So this is what it is. So now we can do this, the sum over sigma I explicitly, right? So what it is. So we have, you know, let's take sigma I equal to, so what we are doing, sigma I equal to plus 1, plus minus 1. And then the terms which we have to sum over are of the form e to 1 over t phi I sigma I. Of course, this is very simple. It's just two exponentials together. And we have done that in tutorial many times. So we know that this is equal to e to logarithm of 2 times cos h phi I over t. Right? So it's just cos h. This is what it is. So now I do it for over all spins. Right? So I'll get a product of these things. So I'll have to sum power n. Okay? So we arrive at magnificent result is that our, regarding the phase transitions, our partition function can be written completely as field theory. So Z equals to an integral over d phi e to minus some action, which is a function of phi, where this action S of phi is equal to, so now whatever I have there left, so it's 1 over 2t, 1 over 2t phi I jij minus 1 phi j, and then putting the product in the exponential, I'll have a sum. It's minus I logarithm of 2 times cos h phi I over t. Okay? And so far, this is exact, apart from the fact that we've thrown away some smooth factor which we don't care about. Okay, so now we have rewritten this as a field theory. Of course, my fields, well, phi I, are defined at a lattice point I. So at this point, my fields are not continuous fields. They are only defined at a given site, here, there, and there, and so on, right? So the next step, you know, to get the full field theory, we want a continuous theory. So now we want to actually zoom out of the system, precisely as we are doing when we are looking at the critical point in this RG block spin. We want to zoom out of the system. As you are zooming out of the system, you are losing track of the lattice, because the lattice is smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and in the end, it's continuous, right? So this is what we'll do next. So we'll just do take a continuous limit of this and concentrating on the non-analytic part of your partition function. Yes?
You're plotting this exponent in the integral of the fields in action. Can we somehow see that the fields are going to follow the equation of motion that comes from this action to stationary? Or why do we plot in action?
Well, so far I'm just using this language. but thank you for that question. it's a good question. So okay, I didn't want to do it, so let me do it. So now you may be interested, so can I still recover from this, let's say, my mean field theory approximation? How does my mean field theory approximation look like? And the answer is that mean field theory approximation is equivalent to taking the stationarity of this action, precisely, as you ask. So it's basically WKB approximation, which you are doing if you have Hamilton-Jacobi theory or whatever, wave optics to Hamilton-Jacobi theory. So let me write down the statement. So note, because you asked, we have to have it. So mean field theory is actually equivalent to saddle point approximation, or WKB approximation, saddle point approximation. Whatever. Approximation. So let phi 1 bar and phi 2 bar and then phi n bar be a configuration that minimizes my action S. Okay. So let's assume that. So of course, how I get that is I take ds over d phi I. And then I plug phi I equal to phi I bar, and this must be stationary, so S is equal to 0. That's my approximation. So now, if you look at what it gives you, so if I differentiate this S of phi with respect to phi, I kill always one phi. Okay, so this gives you 1 over, so it's 2 times 1 over 2t, so it's 1 half, 1 over t, and then sum over j, jij to minus 1 phi j. That's the first term if I differentiate it. And the second one is a logarithm. So if I differentiate logarithm, I get 1 over that thing, and I have to differentiate cos, which gives me sines. So in the end, it's just tangents. So it's 1 over t tangents h phi I over t. So I know this. Okay. So in other words, because I assume it's invertible, now I can multiply everything by jij. So I'll be having jij here, and this will just become delta. So from here, you find that phi I prime equals the sum over j, jij. Then probably tangents. It's a typo in my notes, phi j over t. Okay. So this is my equation. Now, one more step you have to do is that you are saying that this is something like an average value. Of course, my lattice is uniform. So average value is the same everywhere in every lattice point. Right? So you know that phi I equals to 5 for all I. Right? So it's just some number phi. So in other words, what it's written here, and then you also use definition. So now this is just phi. It doesn't depend on index j because it's just a uniform lattice. And then you define this thing to be j. So sum over j, jij, is some new quantity j, which we done in the tutorial before. So what you are getting out of this is that phi bar equals to j times tangens h phi bar over t. So now if you compare this thing to what we've seen in the tutorial, it's precisely mean field theory approximation. So this is the equation which you got in mean field theory. So mean field theory equation. And so what I have to do is probably set phi equals to m times j. So we had a mean field theory equation for m. It was m equals to j times tangent j tangent of m over t, which is what we've seen in our tutorial. So indeed, so if I just take the most crude approximation to whatever I have written here down, I just recover the mean field theory approximation. It's really the first step you can do. So now you might think, okay, so can I do better if I expand, you know, to higher orders, if I expand S to, let's say, second order or third order and so on? What you'll find out is actually, well, you can try, but it doesn't work. So you'll find that actually the fluctuations are actually important, and you encounter some infinities and so on. So this is not the way to go, that you would be expanding to higher orders, calculating order by order this thing. Doesn't work. Okay, so you have to go to the normalization. But let me not do this here. So we have this field theory description of our problem. So now the second step is to do the continuum limit. So basically, we want to go from phi I, which is defined at site I, to a continuous field, to phi x, basically. Right? This is the next step we want to do. And again, we can do this because we are interested in a critical point which has this fractal structure, which has this scaling invariance. So I can zoom out of the system. The lattice becoming smaller and smaller, becoming effectively continuous. So that's the idea. So zoom out. Zoom out. Which means that loose information about underlying lattice. Okay, so that's the idea of the limit. Let me do it step by step. So first of all, what you can do is that, of course, you want to simplify your life. And the thing which we have been doing before, you want to expand this logarithm in the powers. So let's say that the fluctuation, well, whatever, the field is small. The magnetization is small, close to the critical point. So I can expand this logarithm in powers of this small x. The first term will be proportional to x. The other term will be, okay, let me do it. So the first step is that logarithm of 2 times cos h phi I over t So the first term is logarithm of 2, which is just a constant term, doesn't help me, so I will just drop it out. Then I have 1 half phi I over t square, and then I have quartic term, minus 1 over 12 phi I over t to the power 4, plus other things, okay? So I just don't care about this one. It's definitely not helping me. And I have to expand. I'll discuss this a little bit later, but I have to expand at least to the fourth order. You can go to higher order. Doesn't really help you, but you can go to higher order. But at least you have to go to the fourth order. Okay? Okay. So now, horrible calculation. Okay? So if you look at what we are trying to do is that we have this first term here, and then we have those three, quadratic term in phi and quartic term in phi. Okay? So let me first look at this term, and we have to do some work, actually, with this term. And it's quite difficult, so it's a page calculation, so let me do it. So that you have all the steps there, and let me convince you that it gives you something interesting. Okay? So, but it's a painful calculation, so let's do it. I don't want that. I want front up. And okay. So look at the term phi I j I j minus 1 phi j. And of course, what you want, yes? Oh, well, because you know from this, let's say, mean field theory approximation, that phi is something like a magnetization. You are concentrating on the vicinity of critical point. So you know that the magnetization actually is zero, almost zero at a critical point, right? It's smooth and nice and very, very small. So that's why you can expand this thing. So in this mean field, in this settle point thing, you showed that you get an equation like that. And now you can compare to your mean field theory approximation, which you will get an equation which is m equals to j times tangens m over t, which we did in tutorial. So actually now you can relate basically what this phi, average phi, how it is related to your magnetization. So you're just, you know, getting the same thing. So from there you know that the average phi is something like an average magnetization in your system, and you know that that is small, close to the critical point. Okay, so now we want to look at this term, and for that we want to use a lattice Fourier transform. Okay, so using lattice Fourier transform. So it sounds more horrible than it is. So basically, what it is that if I have phi defined at my side I can go to a Q space. So now, because everything is discrete, I will have sums instead of integrals, which I will, in the end, anyway, transform to integrals. But okay, so it's sum over Q, phi of Q. That's my Fourier picture of that. Q times Ri, where Ri is precisely the vector which goes to my side I. You can do the inversion of that, and because the lattice, everything is, you know, translation invariant, you can actually do, you can transform even objects with two indices. Okay, so before I do the inverse, let me do two indices here. And you can show that because of the lattice translation invariance, this is just E to Q times, as you would expect, Ri minus Rj. So I think everybody can believe this. Why not? Because of translation invariance. It only depends on, you know, how far these I and J are. Okay. So one last thing which I'll need, two more things. Well, whatever. I need from lattice Fourier transform is that how to decompose a delta function. So it's sum over I e to minus I. Now I have two wave numbers, k and k prime. Times Ri, and this just gives you the delta k prime. And the inverse of this is 1 over you sum over q e to minus, I probably should be somewhere plus, doesn't matter. Ri rj equals to delta ij. Which one is plus? This one is plus. So this one should be probably plus. Okay. So this is just, you know, discrete version of your familiar Fourier transformation. So nothing so far so ugly. Okay. So now let me use these things to write what that term is. So I have sum over I and j, phi I, j I j to minus 1, phi j. So that's my term I'm struggling with. So now I Fourier transform everything. So I Fourier transform phi, I Fourier transform j, phi, Fourier transform that one. So I have three Fourier transforms. Okay, so this is equal to sum over I and j. And then I have 1 over n, sum over q, phi q, e to I q ri, then 1 over n sum over q prime g minus 1 of q prime e to q prime ri minus rj, and finally 1 over n, sum over q double prime, phi q double prime, ei q double prime, rj. Okay. I just, you know, Fourier expanded everything. So now you want to do explicitly the sum over I and j. And you can easily do it. So if you look at the sum over I, so the only thing which contains I is this exponential here and this part of the exponential here, right? It's just the sum over exponential. So now I can use this guy here and it will just give me delta q q prime, right? So now what I'm doing is that I'm doing sum over I and j. So and for the j is the same thing. So the only thing which depends on j is this exponential and that exponential here, right? So okay, so this is equal to, and you see that when I'm using when I'm trading these exponentials for my delta, I always eat 1 over n. So in the end, I kill 2 1 over n, so I'll have only one left. So it's 1 over n, sum over q, q prime, q double prime, now phi q, j minus q prime, phi q double prime, and then I have delta q q prime with a minus sign, and delta q prime q double prime here. So this is what you get when you sum over I and j, just trade them to delta functions. And of course, now I can do explicitly these sums, let's say of q prime and q double prime. So in the end, you have just 1 over n, only one sum over q, phi minus q, j minus 1 of q, and then phi of q. Okay. So this is my Fourier transform of this term. So now you basically trade it. So this is beautiful, right? So you trade it two sums over I and j to only one sum over q. So that's the big advantage you have from here. So now, in order to proceed further, you need to know what a JQ is. Okay. So let's have a look what JQ is. So which one I don't need? Maybe that thing there. Thank you.
the question is, what is
JQ? So what it is, of course, is a Fourier transform of my Jij, right? So it's 1 over n, sum over ij, Jij, e to minus iq times ri minus rj. Okay, so now the trick is that we are zooming out of the system. That's the whole point. We are zooming out of that. We want to get continuous limit. So for that reason, we can concentrate on very, very large distances. So distances are large, but the momenta are small, right? So what this guy here is, so this is like a typical range of my interaction. Ri minus rj is only non-trivial. Well, typical range of the interaction. So let's say the lattice spacing. So Ri minus rj is typically A, the lattice spacing. But Q, if I'm zooming out of the system, concentrating on larger and larger distances, Q is really, really small, right? So I want small q. So in other words, your condition will be that Q times R, where R is the typical range of in the interaction, let's say the lattice spacing of A. So Q times A or Q times R is much more than one, because you're concentrating on very, very small momenta. Okay, so in that case, I can actually expand this exponential and keep just first two terms. Basically, that's the whole idea, because you are concentrating on small q, large distances, small q, zooming out. So zoom out. Okay, so what it is, it's 1 over n, sum over ij, jij. And then the first term, what is 1? The other term is minus iq times ri minus rj. And the next term is minus 1/2 q times ri minus rj square. And then you have other terms. Okay. So this is my Taylor expansion. And I can do it because I'm concentrating small momenta. Okay, so the first term is good. So what it is by definition, if you sum over j of jij, it gives you big J without any index. And if you sum it over the other one, it gives you n times big J. So this term actually gives you n times j. Okay. What about the second term? Any ideas? Very good. It is 0. Why is 0? Because this guy is symmetric in I and j. This guy is antisymmetric in I and j. Symmetric times antisymmetric is 0. Okay, so the other term doesn't contribute. So I dealt with that one. And that's why I need to expand to the next order. Okay, so this is equal to, so 1 over n, n times j. So this is just equal to j minus 1 over to n, sum over I and j, and then I have q times ri minus rj. Sorry, question? Yeah. Yeah, you can take it without loss of generality, you take it symmetric. Yeah, exactly. So it's equal to this. So now you do very, very crude estimate. So first of all, this term, it depends on q square, right? It depends on q square. So it's q square times something. So now this thing will be non-zero only if you are at a typical range of interaction. So you say this thing here is something like a q square times r square. And then oh, sure. Thank you. Jij. So now what you will do is that you say this is like q square r square. Now you have sum over j ij, I over j. So they are just doing very, very crude approximation here. Well, basically, people don't do it. They just say, well, this is proportional to q square, and something I don't really know. Let's call it a spin stiffness. Okay, so they say this is just equal to q square times spin stiffness, and whatever you don't know, they just put into this spin stiffness here. So anyway, so what is this? Approximately is q square r square, and you have sum over ij, jij, which again gives you James times m. And usually people define, just to keep track of the dimensionality of the system, they just divide by d. Of course, you can play with the range of the interactions, so you can adjust it to anything you want. You can do various things. So anyway, what people say is that this equals to j minus 1/2, and then whatever is stands here is the spin stiffness, but it's proportional to q square, the magnitude of q square. And so kappa is called spin stiffness. And you know, very, very approximately, this spin stiffness is like r squared j over 2 over d. But you know, that's only something. It's not that important. What is important is that this is proportional to q squared. Yes? This term will. No. So you have n here, and then you have 1 over n here. Oh, so. But this thing is, you know, it's a typical range of the interaction. You don't scale that, right? It's still the same. No matter how I look at the system, the typical range of the interaction stays the same, right? You don't change that. Sure. No, but you know, you sum only. So these gijs basically tell you, you know, which sides I'm summing over, right? And because they remain the same, right? So this is definitely something finite, because you have finite range of interaction. Yes. Oh, it's just the people like to, well, if you don't like D there, don't put it there. Doesn't matter. Okay, so you know, I can all, yeah, people put D there, but this is only very, very crude estimate. What is really important is that what stands here, this kappa, actually is positive quantity. That's what is important. And that this is basically proportional to q square. These are the only two things which are important. Okay, so now we can celebrate. We have all the results, basically. Yeah, which is 1 over this. Yeah. Okay. So this was the horrible calculation. So now we just have to pick up the pieces. So now what people define is S05, which will be the non-interacting part of your field theory, which you define to be 1 over 2 t square sum over I and j t phi I j I j minus 1 phi j minus phi I square here. So if you look at our thing here, it's really the first term of S of phi. There's this one here, there. And it's the first non-trivial term of the expansion of the logarithm. Okay? Then I will have the quartic term as well, which I will add later. But that will be like an interactive part of these things. So this is what you call that. So now we have seen that this is equal to 1 over 2 t square n. So we found what this term is over there. So it's sum over q phi minus q. And then what is over there is actually 1 over j, and then I have t here, so it's t over j of q, and then minus 1. And if you do the Fourier transformation of phi I square, it just gives you phi q, phi q minus phi q. Okay, so phi q. So this is what it is. So the first, so this guy just comes from here, and this minus 1 comes from there. Okay, so now you can plug for this guy here what it is, and we calculate it over there. So jq is j minus 1 half kappa q square. And of course, you treat q very, very small, so you can expand in q. So what this is, and also remember that we done that in tutorial. You called the j without any q dependence. You call it tc, just from mean field theory approximation. That's what we've done in the tutorial. Right? So what this is t over j without q, which is tc. Now I have this minus 1 there. And then plus r square t over 2d tc q square. I'm just plugging whatever that stiffness is, keeping that d, which is there. Again, it's not very important. What is important is that this guy is t. So it's equal to t plus something which is positive and quadratic in q square 2d. Again, I'm using that I'm close to tc. So t is equal to tc here. So far, so good. So now there is some stupid redefinition of fields. So let me just write it, and you can do it explicitly if you want. So you say that you go from tc square root of 2d r a to d half phi. So this is my transformation of field. And then you also define a new thing, r, which will be 2 times d times t, t minus tc over tc, and r square. Okay, so if you do that, so I just plug everything here. I do that redefinition of the field. And I end up with something which is very, very nice, almost there. So it's equal to 1 over 2n a to some power d, sum over q, phi minus q, now r plus q square, and phi of q. Okay. So I hope you can believe that this is what it is. So I definitely have here q square somewhere. So I have q square here, and then have something which is some bollocks of something, combination of some constants. But what is very important is that this r is proportional to small t. Okay, it's proportional to t minus tc over tc. So it's something that will change sign when I cross the critical temperature. Okay, so the last step, of course, is to say, well, I want to change this sum over q with some appropriate measure, which will be 1 over n a to the d to an integral over q. Right? So if I'm zooming out of the lattice, it doesn't matter. A is much smaller than the large of them, than the size of my system. So I just change this to an integral. So I have 1 half, and now dd of q 2 pi to power d and phi minus q r plus q square phi of q. Okay, so you can sort of believe that. I have the appropriate measure there, everything is fine. So now you want to change integration over the momentum to an integration over the space. Right, and you know that the Fourier transform. How do you get q squared times the corresponding function? If you have a derivative, exactly. So this is actually this q squared term is an origin of nabla phi squared term. Okay, so if I write this in a position space, this is 1 half d to the d of x. Nabla phi square plus r phi square. Okay, just undo the Fourier transform. Okay. So that's the non-interacting part of my action. So now, I dealt with phi I, j I, j phi j, and I dealt with the first term, phi I square term here. So I just add the phi to the four term. And of course, if you do again the Fourier transform and everything, then you find you can easily convince yourself that, that it just gives you phi to the four, right? It cannot be anything else. So it gives you some constant times phi to the four. So now if I write down that action over there, so this action here, when expanded close to the critical point, you find that S of phi, full S of phi, equals to e to the x, now 1/2 lambda phi square plus r over 2 phi square plus another constant u over 4 factorial phi to the 4. So now you manage to rewrite your action functional, if you are interested in the vicinity of the critical point, as a field theory, right? Yes?
You know something about the sine of u?
Yes. So if you look at here, it's, you know, it's phi to the 4, and then it's 1 over t. It's always positive. So actually, if you work through that, you find that u must be positive. Okay. So this is your result. So now we have really, really field theory, continuous field theory, which is, you know, which you describe our phase transition, right? I started with microscopic Ising model, but now I have field theory. You know two things. So this thing is called Landau-Ginzburg functional. Landau-Ginzburg functional. When people actually write it down for various theories, they don't go through this painful process usually, but they just write it down. Okay, so this thing just comes from the fact that I can vary my field phi in space. It doesn't have to be uniform, so they just argue that this term must be there. And then I can write any powers of phi so that I respect my original symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So my original symmetry of the Hamiltonian is sigma goes to minus sigma, give me the same thing. So that's why you have only even powers of phi here in this functional. So you can basically write it down immediately. So now you may be asked, so that's why you cannot have term like phi cube, for example. So you may be asking, can I have terms like lambda phi square times phi square? The answer is yes, you can have, but they don't matter. And we can show that later, but I will have no time to show that. Equally, you can say, can I go to phi to the 6? The answer is yes, you can, but it doesn't matter. So this is really basically the most general thing which matters for us. Okay, and so we have from the derivation. So this you can write immediately down, and from the derivation, going through this, I don't know, 45 minutes derivation, we just learn two important things. One of them is that r changes sign as you cross TC. Okay. So r is something like small t. And the second thing, which I haven't really shown, that u must be positive. But you can sort of convince yourself that it must be the case. So very, very important lesson which you learn is that r changes sign. At the transition, in other words, r is proportional to t, small t, t minus tc over tc. And second thing is that u is actually positive. And even if you didn't know that from the derivation, you would argue that for stability, actually, this must be the case. So also for stability, this must be the case. And then I just let me just write it down, but I don't give you any proof. So you can, you know, can write this immediately. Respecting symmetry sigma to minus sigma, which means that you must have basically even powers of phi. So you can have phi 2, phi 4, phi 6, and so on. And then you can show that higher powers of phi or derivatives do not matter, are irrelevant. So really, this phi to the 4 theory is the most general thing you can write down. So what it is, actually, if you look at that, and you know it from your field theory course, so you must get something like, so if I don't have this interacting term here, you have massive Klein-Gordon equation. So the only thing is that you don't live in Lorentzian spacetime. You live in, so you weak rotate your time to an Euclidean time, basically. So this is like massive Klein-Gordon equation, but in imaginary time. So you get a field theory, but it's not a Lorentzian field theory. Doesn't have the right signature of the metric.
If we know the theory in principle is phi, what is that from the original problem?
We shall see. Wait for it. Yeah, it's a very good question. So I convince you that phi is something like the mean magnetization, but basically it allows you to identify exactly when the phase transition happens. It allows you to calculate these critical exponents, everything. So really this phi is something which is, you know, related to your problem, really. It's something like a magnetization, something like your order parameter. But yeah, you need to work for it a little bit more. Okay, so let me, 1:45. So let me, 5 minutes. So we had part one, right? And then we had part one. Part one was like our goal, and part two was something else. So now we have part three, and let's say dimensional analysis. And it'll be only 5 minutes, don't worry. So, well, there are various ways to do dimensional analysis, and people doing GR like to measure things in lengths. People doing high energy physics like to measure things in energies. So because this was basically mainly developed by people working in high energy physics, so you will measure things in energy. So we will assign the dimension of the momentum to be plus one, and then anything which is a length will have minus one. So we are using units of energy. So now, of course, we are setting h bar and all these things equal to one. So that's why the dimensions of your action, because you have e to minus s, must be zero. So it doesn't have any dimensions. So the dimensions of s is zero. So now, of course, it looks like d to the dx times nabla of phi square. So let's look at this first term here. So this has dimensions minus d. Nabla has dimensions, it's 1 over dx, so it has dimensions plus 2. And then phi has dimensions of phi. So what it gives me is x to the d has has dimension minus d plus nabla square, which has dimensions of 2, plus dimensions of phi square, which has dimensions of phi. And this is equal to 0, right? So from here, you know that the dimensions of my field phi is d minus 2 over 2. Okay. So equally, you can ask what are the dimensions of my coupling constant r. And just looking at this, it's obvious that the r has the same dimensions as nabla square. So it must have dimensions 2. So r has dimensions 2. And finally, u, and you'll find that it has dimensions 4 minus d. For minus d, very, very important. That's why people call it epsilon. So 4 minus d, from now on, the definition of epsilon. And very, very important, right? And why is it important? Is that this 4 is important. And 4 is that important, it has its own name. It's called upper critical dimension. Okay? So this 4 is called upper critical dimension. And basically, it tells you that the mean field theory is actually exact if you are in d equal to 4 and higher dimensions. So mean field theory is exact if you are. So what it will show in your tutorial on Friday is that really you might be thinking, OK, can I really go to phi 6, phi 8, and so on? But you'll show that exactly if you are in d equal to 4 dimensions, then these terms do not matter. So that's the simplest thing which we can show. So, you know, it's a statement just coming from the dimensional analysis. And you will see your tutorial 9. And you will see that in d equal to 4, you can have only terms up to phi to the 4, which means the phi to the 6 and so on do not matter. Okay. And as I tried to mention before, you might think I can actually do better if I expand these things in higher powers. It doesn't help you. In the same way, you might think doing perturbation theory in quantum theory, you might be able to do perturbations in small u, in small interacting term. Doesn't help you either to understand critical phenomena. So actually, you cannot do perturbation theory on this action. Doesn't lead anywhere. You have to do the full thing, the full renormalization. Okay, and let me start this renormalization tomorrow. Okay, so questions? Yes? Yeah, it indicates if you have, you know, negative mass, it indicates some kind of instability or something like that. Which is precisely what happens here, right? You are starting creating some right. Oh, I see. Okay. To be honest, I don't know, but the truth is that you are not really in Lorentzian space anyway. So it's a good question. I don't know. So here, definitely, R can change sign if you are doing this field theory. But yeah, how it is exactly related to your mass? Oh yeah, but I would say it indicates some kind of instability on your system. Yeah. We will see that on Friday. We'll see that on Friday. Don't worry. Wait for that. Yeah, it's a good question. But we will see it explicitly on Friday. We're asking all the questions which we need to address. Thank you for those, but wait two more lectures. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much.